about the mission that has brought Mr. Garton here. Mr. Garton has been speaking in Amman just a few days ago, where we held a regional, where we held a conference in Amman, Jordan, bringing together Jordanian and Palestinian officials, NGO, media, to speak about the trade and environment issue. One of the very first times that trade and environment was spoken about with the Jordanian public in the Jordanian media. And it received considerable press coverage, both in the Jordanian Arabic press and the English press. Yesterday, we were in the Knesset, and Mr. Garton spoke in the Knesset before the Economic Committee, and again highlighting the need to take the environment issue as a priority in trade. Mr. Garton, before he rises to speak, a little bit about him. He's, for the last 5 years, he's a member of the European Parliament from the Swedish Greens. He was before that a member of the Swedish Parliament, before that a journalist, an author of some 40 books, a professor in sociology, an expert on the Middle East, and he's been here very many times, and he's visited, I think, every Arab country in the region, as well as Israel, of course. An expert on green issues and an expert on trade. He sits in the Foreign Affairs Committee of the European Parliament, and alternatively, he sits in the Industry Committee of the European Parliament. We're truly delighted and honoured to have him with us. We're very grateful for his coming here, and he will shortly speak. Following Mr. Garton, Alexander Wandel will present specifically about the framework of the Mediterranean Free Trade Zone, and then I will conclude with some comments specific to Israel and the bilateral agreement signed between Israel and the EU and what it means for us here as Israelis. And then we hope to leave some half hour for discussions. So without any further ado, Mr. Garton.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I am very happy to be in an institution that is working with projects and experts both from Israel and Palestine at this very difficult time. And I'm very happy to be invited by an NGO that stubbornly is still going on to work in the whole area, Israel, Palestine, Jordan, and also with some links to other Arab countries. I think it's very important, and that's why I thought it obvious that I should come. Although it's difficult and it may be dangerous, but I think, after all, it's worthwhile to go on discussing these very important problems of the future, because I think that cooperation around a common environment is one of the bases for a common future, and that will promote peace. As has been said, I've been a member of the European Parliament since 1995, when Sweden joined the European Union. However, I don't represent here in any way the European Union officially, because I belong to the opposition inside the European Union, in the sense that I belong to the Green Group, and the Green Group is, you could say, an opposition group, mainly when it comes to environmental policies and trade. We are very much in opposition. So don't misinterpret me in the way that I should represent the European Union in any official way. Of course, I am coming from the European Union, and I'm not ashamed of that, but I belong to a minority group concerning the issues we're going to discuss tonight. I've been involved in this problem of trade and an environment since a couple of years, more than earlier from Seattle. I was in Seattle as a member of the European Parliament, a delegation. I was also in the streets, I must admit, although not among those fighting, because I'm a pacifist, so I don't think you should fight anywhere, not even in a demonstration in a democratic state. You should always use peaceful means. It would have been better for everybody if that was the case everywhere. But I was in the peaceful demonstrations in Seattle. I've been in quite a few other peaceful demonstrations in Gothenburg, in Sweden, in Nice, and so on, Prague, and wherever, Geneva, where trade and environment was either the main item or one of the items. Lately, I was in Doha, in Qatar, as member of the European Parliament delegation once more. And our role was to observe, watch, monitor the behavior of the European Commission. And we were not completely satisfied with that. And I'll come back to that shortly. But let me start with some basics about trade. Already several years ago, when I was debating the benefits of trade with some liberals who more or less believe that trade is always good and there are no problems with it. The more trade you have, the richer everybody will become. And they were referring to Adam Smith, the well-known book, The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776. So I thought I should check and control. So I went to the university library of my university in Lund in southern Sweden, and they found for me a copy, an original copy of the edition of 1776. And I took that copy and I started to read, and already on the first page there was important information, because it was said, author Adam Smith, professor of moral philosophy. He was not professor of economics or commerce or something like that. He was professor of moral philosophy. And when you read the book, you found that he was, of course, in favor of liberalizing the economic system of that time, which was full of restrictions. But he also took for granted that when you took away formal regulations and formal restrictions in laws, restrictions by the state, there would still be a lot of restrictions to the behavior of people coming from the interior of people, coming from a kind of moral. He would not be able to imagine a modern world where people are able to do almost anything for money. If they sell edible food, or if they sell manipulated chemical things labeled as food, doesn't matter to some people. If they sell literature by a Nobel Prize winner, or if they sell pedophile pornography to some people, it doesn't matter. If they build nice houses for people to live in on an area that couldn't be used for other purposes, or if they destroy forests and nature and wildlife and whatever, doesn't matter to some people, as long as they could earn money from it. But to Adam Smith it was, he couldn't have imagined it, because to him it was clear that there would be restrictions coming from inside. But in a world where we don't, not all of us, have these restrictions from inside, maybe you will have to have some other restrictions to the so-called free trade in order to make it fair trade. And it's from this conviction I and most other Greens have. We are not against trade, of course. That would be very stupid. But we think there should be some kind of organization and framework for what kind of trade is allowed in order to make trade benefit all of us and not destroy social circumstances and social conditions and environment. And as you will hear more about in detail later, as Israel, one of the countries having an association agreement, where trade is an important aspect, the most important aspect, probably, with the European Union and 11 other countries south of the Mediterranean also have or will have such agreements. And while the aim is to create a kind of free trade zone, and I am coming from the European Union, you could say from the internal workings of the European Union, I see my purpose or my aim here as, in a way, warning you for this partner you're going to have, because it's a strong partner, and it's a partner with many good sides, but not only good sides. And you should be prepared for a closer cooperation with this European Union. Basically, the European Union is a free trade zone itself, which developed into a customs union very early. And later, through a lot of treaties, Maastricht Treaty, Amsterdam Treaty, Nice Treaty, and so, is developing further into kind of maybe a federation or whatever. We don't know, and we are not unanimous about that, and we discuss it. But from an economic point of view, the European Union is, since quite a long time, a customs union, which includes a free trade zone. And it is a single market where there should be free movement for commodities, for services, for labor, and for capital. That's the basic idea of the European Union. So you could draw some experience from the European Union what might happen if you have such a cooperation between a lot of countries, 15 countries now in the European Union, with another 12 countries as applicant countries may join in the coming 5 to 10 years. Now, I'll give you just some few examples. There is one very recent example where you have this balance between environment and trade, where it's very obvious that there is a conflict between free trade and environmental concerns. And that's where, when it becomes difficult, because then the question is, what should have priority? Should a country be allowed to protect its environment, even if this constitutes restrictions against free trade? That is a conflict we have almost every day inside the European Union. And one of the most recent examples concerns beer and beer cans, which have been banned in Denmark since ever. They drink a lot of beer, but they don't drink it from cans. They drink it from recycled bottles. And that is a deeply entrenched tradition in Denmark, that you buy your beer and even other drinks in bottles, and when you're going to buy a new beer, you bring your bottles back to the shop, and then you get new bottles with beer in, and so on. And it goes on like that. And the Danes have kept this ban, although especially the German beer industry has been very outrageous. They have found it outrageous, and they have been really trying to change this. And now recently they were successful at the court, European court in Luxembourg, which is the court of the European Union, which is decided on such conflicts. And the court has said that this can ban is a restriction, is a non-allowed, non-permitted restriction against free trade. So now the Danes are going to let the cans in. Yeah, that will happen in the near future. So that's one example where the European court thought that the environmental gains of the ban against cans was not important enough to motivate this restriction against free trade. We have another, we have many cases, I won't tell you all of them. We have another rather special case in Sweden, where rather something like 10 years ago already, we had an enormous debate about animal rights and concerning egg-laying hens. They were more and more often kept in cages. I think that might be the case even here. It's probably all around the world nowadays. And these were rather small cages. And one of the persons reacting against this was the very recently deceased, pretty well-known author even outside Sweden, Astrid Lindgren, who wrote this Pippi Longstocking and many other children's books. And she was active in a campaign, and that was very important. So the Swedish parliament decided to ban cages for egg-laying hens and even for other hens. Cages should go. But it should be in a period of, I think it was 10 years, for the industry to adapt to these new circumstances. And this was in the late 80s or early 90s that this was decided. But during these years happened that Sweden joined the European Union. And with the complete free trade with all the other members of the European Union. And now it happens that there are egg-laying hens in some other countries of the European Union, and they don't have the same laws against these cages. So when the date for implementation completely of this new law came closer, the egg producers told the government that if we implement this law, there will be no more Swedish eggs, because then we will buy all these eggs from Finland or Germany or some other countries where you don't have these laws. And then we need protection. But there couldn't be any protection because there should be free movement of all kinds of goods inside the European Union. So we couldn't introduce a protective law demanding that, for instance, that eggs imported to the country should come from hens outside, free-going hens outside cages. That is not possible according to the European Union laws. So what happened was that this law was more or less discarded. And poor Astrid Lindgren, she was very upset, and one of the last things she said in her life publicly was that she felt cheated, that the government and politicians had promised her, really, to make away with the cages for hens. And so she died with the cages still there, and even knowing that probably they will remain until maybe, possibly, we will be able to convince the Finns and the Germans and the others also to ban cages. Maybe. That is, of course, a possibility. But one country couldn't have different rules. That is either illegal or, for market reasons, not possible. So this is what might happen when free trade is given priority. Another example is not coming from the European Union, but what free trade, complete free trade, could do. I have been very active the last years concerning relations between European Union and China, because I have been the president of the so-called China delegation, so I have had a lot to do with China. And as you may know, China has recently joined the WTO, the World Trade Organization. Now, there was enormous debate in China about that. They even allowed books to be published criticizing this decision, because they said, the critics, that China will lose, China not prepared, not strong enough, will lose a lot of jobs, etc., etc., etc. And the interesting thing is that 2 days ago in a Jordanian newspaper, I saw an article big like that saying that now the Chinese Minister of Labor has estimated that they will lose 20 million jobs because of the entry into the WTO. Okay, China is big, so 20 million jobs is not like 20 million jobs here. But anyhow, 20 million jobs is still 20 million human beings who will lose their jobs. Pardon? Well, there will be American farmers, and there will be a lot of industry from Europe also coming in and so on, maybe Swedish farmers even. Yeah, but that is the case. It's a big country, they have developed a lot, but they are not strong enough. And when the government institutions admit 20 million losses, maybe the reality will be 30 or 40 million losses. So that's a heavy price to pay for this so-called development. Is it worth it, really? Or maybe some type of development is going too rapidly. So the European Union is part of this game, and you should be aware that the European Union has many good sides, many good aspects, it's very good cooperation, but the actions of the European Union, just like any big power in the world, is not only for the benefit of others, if you believe that, but probably this is a realistic bunch of people, so you didn't believe it. But it's very often also for the benefit of itself. I'll give you a couple of examples. Turkey has a customs union treaty now with the European Union, and there was an estimation just recently who have gained from that. And it was in a European Commission report. And they said that the exports from the European Union has increased by 40%, but the exports from Turkey to the European Union has increased only by 15%. So the imbalance the gap in the balance of trade has doubled since this customs union was implemented, and that is only 4 or 5 years ago, so it hasn't been very many years. So, of course, the stronger partner, at least at the outset, is usually winning. We had this meeting in Doha, and I could write a book about it. Probably I will write a book about it, because it's a long story, and I won't give you the whole story. But those of you who are interested in trade, you may remember that before Doha, which was in October, it was just sometime after the 11th of September, November it was. Almost every actor from the developing world imaginable came out negatively against the plans of the European Union and the United States to start the so-called new round. You had the 77 group, which is a major group of developing countries. You have the lowest developing countries. You had even the so-called G15 group, which consists of 15 major developing countries like India, Pakistan, Brazil, Egypt, and so on, where the chambers of commerce, so this is not only a kind of left-wing criticism, chambers of commerce made a booklet that was distributed in Doha also, where they said that they think that the developing countries, the industries of the developing countries, have the right to some protection, because if they are not protected until they are strong enough, they will not be able to compete with industries from the developed countries. So that was unanimity against this so-called new round. And the new round, in abbreviated form, you could say, the plan is to enlarge the scope of free trade, the logic of free trade, not only to be about commodities and services, you would say the conventional free trade, but to also include investment, public procurement, public services, and a lot of things that not always are included in the concept of free trade, but they want to enlarge the scope of free trade. So free trade logic should rule a lot of things outside the trade with commodities and services. Means that as an individual country will not be able to have any checks and balances and controls concerning investment, and no checks and balances concerning public procurement. I mean, for instance, public procurement, then a country will not be able to say that we will favor our own industry. When the state is buying, say, school books or whatever to schools, a state will not be able to say we will favor our own producers of these products, because they will have to let anybody in the world give a bid. And if a Chilean or a Canadian firm is giving a better bid for school books in the Philippines, so they should have the order and produce the school books for the Philippines, and the neighboring industry producing school books in the Philippines will not have the order and will be out. From a very commercial point of view, there are some points in this, there is more competition and everything, you know. But from a social point of view, well, anyhow, most developing countries don't accept this. We have this system now inside the European Union. And although European Union countries nowadays are not equal, but there is a certain balance, it creates problems for us, but not that much problems as it would create if every developing country also had to follow the same rules. So these are, I think, they have pretty good arguments, all these developing countries who say, at least not now, it's too early. Imbalances are too great between the poor and the rich. We are not strong enough. We have enough problems with those WTO rules already applicable to us concerning commodities and services usually. But to enlarge this, no thank you, no new round. And what happened in Doha? Well, there was a tough fight. And from my point of view and from point of view of these agreements between the European Union and Israel and the other countries around here, the interesting thing is, of course, how did the European Union act? Did the European Union side with the developing countries, or did the European Union side with the United States and a couple of other highly industrialized countries? Well, of course, the European Union sided with the United States and the other industrialized countries. I mean, that's a fact. It's pretty natural. That's the way it is. But, I mean, it was not the other way around. And arms were twisted and so on, and it was really interesting to see, and I won't tell you this story because it would take hours, but it ended up with only one being left, India, and they prolonged the whole process for 24 hours, but then finally India also gave in. And there was a kind of agreement that is, if not 100%, at least 90%, the way the US and the EU wanted it, and there will be a new round in 2003, no doubt about it. There is some negotiation still to do, but it moves in that direction. And I think that proves that when Israel is, of course, somewhere in between. Israel is not a developing country like Jordan or Egypt or the others. So Israel is in that way stronger. It's not the same thing. But when the developing world is negotiating with the strong, economically strong countries of this world, they must be aware that these economically strong countries, there is still no example where a very economically strong developed country acts only for idealistic reasons to support. Or you could say even with a vision for the future, really. Because then they would even for egoistic reasons support the developing countries, I think. But they are pretty short-sighted, most of them, when it comes to money and when it comes to so-called realpolitik. That's what's a pity. And the conclusion is, of course, that when there is such a free trade zone coming up, which is so imbalanced, much more imbalanced than the European Union has been and still is, between European Union at one side and 12 southern Mediterranean states on the other side, those other 12 countries should cooperate, which they don't do now. Now there are all these bilateral agreements between the European Union and Israel, between the European Union and Jordan, European Union, Palestine, and so on, but there is almost nothing between. Not even between the Arab countries, not very much. And, of course, far less between Israel and the different Arab countries. And it may sound completely absurd to say this at this difficult times, that you should cooperate before you join a free trade zone with the European Union. But still, that is a conclusion, that including Israel, and I should cooperate with all these other neighbors you have, not only for peace reasons, but also for economic reasons, and this is very closely linked to each other. And in that way, in some funny way, I hope that what is needed economically may also contribute to peace, of course. And then peace will contribute to economic development in the whole region. And this way it's linked. And then it will contribute to a better environment. Because I think this cooperation around a common environment, a real common interest for the future, that is something that really can contribute to peace. And I will end with one very positive word about an Israeli aspect. And that what I found in Knesset, that you have a special commissioner here for future generations. I know there are some politicians saying it's completely empty, and maybe it is. I am not the one to judge. So I only judge the idea. I don't judge the man, and I don't judge the what's behind it and anything. Israelis will know that better. But the idea of having a special monitoring institution to check if new laws, new rules benefit future generations or not, I think the idea is very great. And one of the things this person and this institute must monitor is, of course, environment, everything that is ecological. And at least he told us, didn't he, that, or there was even a decision taken in the economic committee that this Middle East free trade zone shall be the object of sustainable impact assessment. And I think sustainable impact assessment gives you a lot of information that will force politicians to take adequate decisions. And then you will have a modified free trade, which nobody is against, but a modified free trade, but in the framework of strong social and ecological concerns. Thank you.
Thank you very much.